how many people were not here yesterday? Okay. So that's all right. You'll catch up. Why are you laughing? Gluttons for punishment. You all came back. Want more, huh? So these are four classes that are derived from three chapters of one of the great classics of world spiritual philosophical literature. It's written by the sometimes called the second Buddha, Nagarjuna, about 2,000 years ago. And the text is called Root Verses on the Middle Way. And it's a text about emptiness. And emptiness is... For practitioners of Mahayana Buddhism, trying to understand emptiness is not optional. It's the core. It's the core of Mahayana Buddhism. Everything follows from it. And all Mahayana Buddhist traditions adhere to the doctrine that things are empty. And so it's very important to work at it, to try to understand what they mean by that. And so so I know it's difficult, and it's a lot easier to come to classes where you talk about loving kindness and compassion and, you know, the 10 wrong things to do and the 10 right things to do, where there are, like, answers, you know, where there are correct answers and you can get 100 on your quiz. But when you confront the deeper philosophical kinds of materials, it's much more difficult, partly because we are so attached to answers. We're so attached to getting, you know, feeling like, well, if I just study this long enough, then I will get it. So there's a difference between wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom and knowledge are not the same. Sometimes they make a distinction in Sanskrit between jnana or prajnana and vijnana. Vijnana means knowledge, you know, facts, data, collecting of data, getting, you know, good at theories and, you know, being able to argue well, debate, you know, and win. Win the debate, win the argument, because you're so clever. And being clever is important. You know, it's not unimportant to be clever. But it's not sufficient for knowledge. For wisdom, I mean, sorry. Knowledge is not sufficient for wisdom. Knowledge and wisdom are two different things. Knowledge tends to enhance the ego. Have you noticed that? It tends to enhance the one who has knowledge. You know, I'm smart, smarter, cleverer, and that is not the road to liberation. Is to build your ego even bigger than it already is. The road to liberation is actually involves the exact opposite of that, of letting go of the ego. And having more and more humility, which also involves the understanding that we are all fundamentally the same, not hierarchically different. See, knowledge hierarchizes people. Wisdom evens it all out. Here's another difference. Knowledge changes you in one kind of a way, in the kind of way I was talking about before, you know, feeling smarter, you know, cleverer. Wisdom changes you in a much deeper way. Wisdom changes you, it works on the hard disk. It's not software. Okay? Knowledge is software. Wisdom is hardware. It changes your very being. Changes who you think you are. And really, what it gets at, ultimately, is the recognition that you are not different from the universe around you. You are not separate. The idea that we are separate from each other and from the world around us is an illusion. Everything exists interdependently, and nothing exists independently. And everything is empty of independent existence. That's what emptiness means. Okay, shall I say it again? It's crucial. Okay? And it's kind of easy to get, you know, knowledge-wise, theoretically, right? It's not that difficult. I'll say it again. Nothing exists independently. No one or nothing exists independently. No thing, no being or person, and no process either. No process. Like, for example, causation, which we talked about yesterday. No thing, no being, no process exists independently or works independently. Everything is in the nexus of interdependence. Okay, and as I mentioned yesterday, interdependence is quite different from dependence. Dependence means something depends on something else, right? When this happens, then this occurs. Yep, this thing depends on this thing. What's the problem with that? Those people are here. This is a review from yesterday, okay? We already talked about this yesterday. What's the problem with saying that a result depends on its cause, for example? What's the problem with that? If you stop there and don't say anything else, what's the problem in saying a result depends on its cause? Cause has to come first, right? The thing that this thing depends on has to be there for this thing to depend on it, right? Okay? That's not exactly correct. Okay? That's not interdependence. And Nagarjuna is arguing that things are empty of independence as well as empty of dependence. Everything exists interdependently, nothing exists independently. So there can't be an independent cause that the result depends on. See what I mean? So what does it mean to say that things exist interdependent? It means there cannot be, like the review from yesterday, okay? These are classes on causation and karma. Today we'll get karma directly, actually. Although they're not really different, causation and karma. There is no cause, there is no effect without a cause. Yes, that's common sense, right? That's the way we usually think about causation, right? A cause happens and then an effect follows from the cause, right? But as we learned yesterday, there can't be an effect without a cause, but there can't be a cause without an effect either. A cause is not a cause until and unless there's an effect that it is a cause for. Okay? So there can't be a cause without an effect. There can't be an effect without a cause. And remember the kicker, okay? The cash out here. Hello, I'm in a class. I can't talk right now. There's no cause without an effect. There's no effect without a cause. And neither one can come first. Cause can't exist without an effect, because if the cause, if without an effect, it's not a cause, right? It has to have an effect to be a cause, right? And there's no effect unless there's a cause that it's an effect of, or for, of. Okay? Neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. And that's interdependence. Okay, that's from yesterday. We did another one like yesterday. This one is my favorite, actually, because it's it's very we're using our senses all the time, right? So it's good to use the senses as an example of this too. This is a visible object, right? Everyone see this? Anyone blind here? Everyone sees this, right? Visible object. Okay, if there was a blind person in the room, would it be a visible object? Okay, so you could say there's no visible object here if you were blind, right? So the visible object depends on a seer that sees the visible object, right? To be a visible object, a seer has to see the visible object, yeah? And to be a seer, you have to see a visible object. If there was a seer who existed without seeing a visible object, that would be an independently existing seer. Does it depend on a visible object to be a seer? And if there was a visible object that didn't depend on the seer to see it, that would be an independently existing visible object, right? Do we usually think that objects are visible objects exist independently of the seeing of visible objects? Yes. The answer is yes. All the time we think this. This is ignorance. This is not the way things exist. This is ignorance. And so we go through all our lives until we come to a Dharma class like this and have to actually, like, think. Go through all our lives deluded. Thinking that things are out there on their own, independently, and that we're in here on our own, independently, too. That there's a perceiver who then encounters perceivable objects. Who are out there, you know, kind of waiting as perceivable objects to be perceived. But they're already perceivable objects. A perceivable object exists only and not until it is perceived by a perceiver. Okay? It brings a perceivable object into existence as a perceivable object. A visible object comes into existence when it's seen by a seer. And not until. Can't exist. It can't exist independent as a visible object. What would it mean to say that there was a visible object that isn't seen by anyone? You see, in what sense is it visible? It becomes visible when it's seen. And in what sense is there a seer who doesn't see anything? It doesn't make any sense. When you stop and think about it, it doesn't make any sense. And that's kind of Nagarjuna's whole project. His whole project is to say, well, let's use logic to think about how you think things exist. And they turn out to be illogical. Our logical, when we use our heads to think about how we think things really exist, we realize that it's impossible. It's impossible for things to exist the way we think that they exist. So then we get some sense, okay? And this is hopefully one of the, one of the goals of a class like this, of a course like this. We get some sense that we're wrong. You know, I think Cindy was mentioning it in one of the evening classes that we heard there's a great scholar and teacher of Buddhism named Jeffrey Hopkins. He's written many, many important books on Buddhism and worked closely with the Dalai Lama. And he had a practice for a while. He said I had a practice. I did a practice for a couple of days or weeks or something like that, where my mantra. You know what a mantra is, right? You say it over and over and over again. Where my mantra was, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. You know? And, studying Nagarjuna is a good way to get that kind of feeling. Like, huh? Everything I thought was, the way things were is wrong. Has to be wrong. And so, then what's right? And see, that's what everyone, wants to know. You know, okay, I'll listen to Nagarjuna, but then, what's the right answer on how things exist? And Nagarjuna said, there is no right answer. Every answer is a wrong answer. Now, why does he say that? Because every answer involves conceptualization. It involves ideas. It involves concepts. It involves words. It involves labeling and so forth. And we mistake our words, our concepts, our labels for reality. Okay? And reality does not fit within our words and concepts. So this, as I mentioned yesterday, this is the real takeaway from Nagarjuna, especially for type A intellectual people like us, who want to know, who want to get it, who really want to get it. He has the same project, the same agenda as the bhakti traditions, as the devotion traditions. The devotional tradition is just like, give it up. Surrender. Surrender your idea that you're in control. And, that was very, very good for people who, had that kind of inclination. And there are still people like that. Not so many in this room, I don't think. And the reason for that is because we're too educated. We're too clever. Too smart. Too successful. Too much type A personalities here. Bhakti, really, devotion isn't really for type A personality. Devotion's for people who, just want to surrender. I just let you surrender. So emotional surrender. Nagarjuna is for people who need to intellectually surrender and give up the idea that you can figure things out with your head. I mean, ultimate things, deep things. You go figure out, like, you know, how to play the stock market, or you can figure out, you know, how to get good at puzzles or something like that. But trying to capture, trying to encapsulate, trying to, you know, like pin a butterfly of reality with your intellect is a losing proposition. And we don't know that until we, you know, confront somebody like Nagarjuna, who blows up our, you know, our kind of security, our certainty that we can figure out how things work. No cause without an effect, but no effect without a cause, and neither one can come first. Neither can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Okay? And that does start to, you know, I don't know how many of you like kind of contemplated that a little bit, but that does start to blow up, you know, your kind of, any kind of understanding on how things work. You know, we can understand how things work if they exist sequentially. Okay? Yeah. If we can say, well, there's a cause and then there's effect. Oh, I get it. The effect came from the cause. Yeah? But then to say the cause came from the effect, and neither cause nor effect can exist without each other, without the other, and neither can come first. What are you left with then, exactly? What are you left with intellectually? So here's another one, okay? There's no karmic producer, okay, a producer of karma, an actor, without the action that the producer produces, okay? This is today's class. There's no actor or agent, you know, there's no agent without the action that the agent is an agent of or for, you know what I mean? I'm going to use today the example of surfing. I spent a lot of time in Southern California when I was a little younger surfing. There's no surfer without the activity of surfing, right? And there's no surfing with the activity without the agent of who is a surfer, okay? Yeah. Neither one can exist without the other. And neither one can come first. That's today's class. Okay. Another example. I mean, you know, if you study the whole text, actually, he just does it. He runs it through one after. It's the same thing over and over and over again. Same argument. And the argument, as I mentioned, is very easy. It's very easy to say. It's very difficult to like get, you know, deeply. And it's kind of interesting how easy it is to sort of say, you know, in words. And how difficult it is to like really get it and believe it and understand it. You know, why is that? It's not that hard. It's not like physics or, you know, advanced mathematics to say that nothing exists independently and everything only exists interdependently. Okay, everyone can get that, right? Everyone can be like, why? You know, these are fairly simple, you know, terms, right? Fairly simple concepts. But then, you know, you start going through it. You start going through any one of these chapters. And you go, wait, well, I don't get it. Because our minds continually go back to grasping onto something that exists independently. The main thing that we grasp as existing independently is ourselves. Me. So last class was chapter 1, the first chapter of the whole text. And that's where he begins seven chapters, of how things externally cannot exist independently, but can only exist interdependently. So the first chapter was, you know, kind of one of the most important, maybe the most important. It's not maybe coincidental that he started in the very first chapter with causation. With causation. How do things happen? See, how do things happen? Out there, in the world. You know, well, how does a cause bring about its effect? You know, can there be a cause without an effect? Can there be an effect without a cause? Which comes first? How does it all happen? In today's class, the commentaries usually say, Nagarjuna doesn't announce it, but the commentaries usually say, okay, now we're going to turn inward. You see, from the external world, we're going to look in the internal world. For those of you who study Buddhist philosophy, me, mine and me, right? The emptiness of mine means the emptiness of my world. And then there's the emptiness of me. So the emptiness of me. So what does emptiness mean again? Does emptiness mean that things do not exist? He calls this the root versus on the middle way. Middle way. So what does middle way mean? A middle way between two extremes. Things do not exist as they appear to us, usually. Okay? They do not exist the way we think they do, almost always. Which is how? Independently. On their own, with some kind of self-nature. Okay? Self-nature means a nature that doesn't depend on something else to be what it is. Yeah? Things don't exist independently, with self-natures. But that doesn't mean they don't exist at all. That's the other extreme. Well, then I guess nothing exists. It's all just a big illusion, and I, you know, the cup isn't really there, and I, you know. It doesn't say that. So, in terms of yesterday's class, he's not saying that causality doesn't work. Causality, it does work. But it works in ways that are unthinkable to us. That it works in ways that we can't pinpoint, we can't capture in our logic, in our rationality, in our words, okay? But it doesn't mean that they don't work. It doesn't work. Causality works. So things exist in the middle between these two extremes, between the extreme of independence and the extreme of not existing at all. So what is that middle way? Interdependence. They exist interdependently. And that's the only way they exist. And in fact, if you look at it, that's the only way they could possibly exist. So, things, external things, are empty. Empty of having independent existence, including processes like causality. So with chapter 8, which we'll start, we'll look at today, he begins the chapters that deal with the emptiness of the inner world, with the self, okay? So many of you probably have studied enough Buddhism or know enough Buddhism to know that this is one of the fundamental tenets of Buddhism. No self. No self. Un-Atman. Un-Atta in Pali, right? And you know, like, well, what the hell does that mean? No self. Does that mean I'm not there somehow? You know, does that mean you're not there? And well, you know, what does it mean? People get the wrong idea. I mean, you know, they parrot the words. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No self, no self, no self. But, you know, well, what does it actually mean? It means that we do not have the self that we think we have. Okay? Doesn't mean that we don't have a self any more than it means, doesn't, that to say that causality is empty means that there isn't such a thing as causality. Okay? It's just, not, there's no self the way we think that there is, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a self. There is a self. There's a self that exists in the same way that everything else exists, which is how everyone should be, like, you know, say the word. Interdependently. Interdependently. And by the way, interdependence doesn't mean that, you know, like in a network, it doesn't mean that there are nodes in the network that are all connected to each other, okay? Because a node would be something that didn't, you know, that existed on its own somehow and then just happened to get connected to other things. Alright? So, I ask you to think, some of you people who were here yesterday, to think about the implications of interdependence. And one of the implications is that, you know, if you think about it, I think, and if you, like, drop the idea of nodes in a network, is that we are the network. It's not that we're a node in the network. We are the network. See, so this is where Nagarjuna and a philosophy, for those of you who studied it, like Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, get very, very similar. Very similar. It's the same idea. We are. You can say we are everything or we are nothing. Either one. We are empty or we are full. There's two ways of talking about the same. We are all. It is all one. Yeah. Or it is all empty. Two ways of talking about exactly the same thing. So who the hell are we? You know? It's a pretty good question, right? Who is the self? And so first of all, we have to get in touch with the self that we think we have in order to understand that that self is impossible. So the usual sort of way of going about it is to say, is the self the same as its parts or different than its parts? And the Gajana loves to do these, what, binary things? You know, is it the same as or different from? And there's kind of like no in between, okay? Same as or different from. So what are the parts of the self? Parts of the self are the body and the mind, right? Body and mind. If you didn't have a body, who would you be? Tinkerbell, or, you know. And if you didn't have a mind, who the hell would you be? Okay? So we are either the same as our parts or different than our parts. The same as our body and mind or different than our body and mind. And there's no third choice. Same as, different than. So you know, this is how you do the meditation on this, actually. You know, you make a little agreement with your mind. Mr. Mind, Ms. Mind, if I were the self I think I am, I would have to be the same as my parts or different than my parts. And then you say, and is there a third option, Mr. Mind, Ms. Mind? And Mr. Mind or Ms. Mind says, no. Because there isn't, actually. Same as or different than. If we were who we think we are, have to be the same as our parts or different than our parts. So if we were our same as our parts, could we be a unitary self? A unitary. You know, when you think of yourself, when you say your name to yourself, how many selves are you talking about? One, right? Unless you've got multiple personality disorder, or unless you're royalty and use the royal we are, you know, doing things. There's one of us in there, right? We think, right? There's one, unitary self. If there was a unitary self that was the same as the parts, let's go looking for it. Is the body, let's start with the body. Body and mind are the parts of the self, right? If the unitary self were the same as the body and mind, is the body one thing or many things? This is another typical Nagarjuna, you know, sort of thing. Because, again, binary, right? Is it one or many? One means one. Many means more than one. Can it be something other than one or many? Those are the only two choices, right? So what is it? Is the body one thing or many things? Quick.
Many things.
Well, then why do you call it a body? How many bodies you got? Many things. Well, if it's many things, then there can't be a unitary self that's identified with the body, right? Unitary means one. And if you're the same as your body, and your body's made out of many parts, then you can't be your body. Okay? The one self, the self that we think exists as a unitary self, can't be the body. What about the mind? Is it one thing or many things? Many things, right? Many things. You've got memories, you've got, you know, feelings, you've got thoughts, you've got all kinds of things going on in your mind. So where's the unitary self if it's the same as the body and mind? Where is it? Okay? If you're the same as your parts, your body and mind, how can you be an unchanging self? Okay? So, you know, when we think about ourselves, we think that there's some part of us that's unchanging, don't we? Like a witness self. When you say that there is a continuity between the time that you were 4 years old and the time that you are now, right? Where is that continuity? Has your body changed since you were 4 years old, do you think? Is there any part of your body that really hasn't changed? You know, every 7 years you get a whole new cellular structure. Do you know that? And it's not like six years and 352 days go by and then they bring you a new cellular structure. Changing all the time, right? Physically, we're changing all the time, moment by moment, right? So where's the unchanging self in the body? What about the mind? Changing or unchanging? All the time changing, right? Every time we have a new perception, a new thought, we change. It's changing all the time. So where's the unchanging self? We think that there's a unitary self. We think there's an unchanging self. Some kind of, you know, witness self that just watches us as we go through change. Yeah? You have that sense? You know, there was a me, and then I was four, and then I went to school, and then, you know, graduated from school, and then I. Who's the I that just watches us go through all of these changes? Watches everything about us go through their changes? physically and mentally, right? Where is that I? Unchanging I. If it's the same as the body and mind, it can't be an unchanging I. Can't be a unitary self, can't be an unchanging self. So then, remember the first part of it is, am I the same as my parts or different than my parts? So that, you can't be the same as your parts, right? And be a unitary and unchanging self. Okay? If you're the same as your parts, you're a multiple and constantly changing set of selves. Okay? That's confusing. I don't feel that way. So maybe I'm different than my parts. This is called an independent self. A self that could exist independently from the body and mind. That we ordinarily think, you know, we depend on our bodies and minds, right? So, but if we depend on our bodies and minds and we're the same as our bodies and minds, we can't be the unitary, unchanging self we think about. So maybe we're different than our bodies and minds. Maybe I could put me over here and my body and mind over here somehow. No, that would be an independent self. An independent self that could exist independently of the body and mind. That's what independence means, right? Is that possible, do you think? If that were possible, you could be in Hong Kong right now where your body and mind sits here. Yeah, separable, right? Separable. Here's another way to think about it. If you were independent of your mind, who would be thinking, I am independent of my mind? Whose mind would that be? Okay? So we can't exist as a unitary self, we can't exist as an unchanging self, and we can't exist as an independent self. And that's what it means to say that the self is empty. Self isn't there. The self that we think is there isn't there, can't be there. Impossible. Here's another one, and this one kind of leads into our class today. We sometimes think of ourselves as an agent self. Sometimes they call this the master self. Like there's a self inside there that controls the body and mind. Right? Headquarters. It's like HQ. I usually think of it up here, right? Mostly up here. This is what I call the Captain Kirk self. Everyone sees Star Trek? Captain Kirk in Star Trek, you know? And he sits up on the deck of the spaceship Enterprise, and he looks out that windshield, kind of like our little windshield here. Say, Captain Kirk's in here somewhere. Little Captain Kirk, little mini-me, sitting up there. And, you know, Captain Kirk sits up there in that commander chair. Ajna Chakra? The Ajna Chakra, right? That's what it means, command center. So, sitting up in the command chair, and looking out at the cosmos, out at the world, and then gives orders to everybody. That's what Captain Kirk does, really. Yeah? Especially Scotty. He's always bossing Scotty around. You know? Scotty do this and Scotty do that. And we have this sense that there's this sort of like agent master self in there that just bosses me around, you know, the rest of me around. Bosses my body around, bosses my mind around, that kind of sense. Everyone have that sense? That would be an independently existing agent self who then gives orders to action. Right? There would be an actor, an agent, Captain Kirk, who then gives orders for everyone to, you know, do stuff. Raise arm and, you know, wipe brow and think this thought and go get some milk and, you know, like all these actions that the agent would command, right? And we have a system, right? That would be also an independently existing self as an agent. So in chapter 8, which is the first chapter that he talks about when he's sort of concentrating on the emptiness of self, he talks about the relationship between agent and action. Agent and action. Okay? And I'll just tell you right now the conclusion, okay? There's no actor that exists independently of the action that the actor is acting. And there's no action that exists independently of an actor acting it. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Okay? We are what we do. So, you know, it's kind of like touching on karma here, right? The principle of karma, which we will get full on Monday night and Tuesday night, next two nights. The whole question of karma. You know, as it's usually understood, the law of karma. How does karma work? And I'll just tell you again right now that Nagarjuna does not say that karma does not work. He does not say, "Oh, just forget about karma. Do without whatever the hell you want. No worries, mate." You know, no. That would be the extreme of nihilism. Now, it's just nothing exists. Now, karma doesn't exist. Nothing exists. But nor does he say karma works the way you think it does. Karma does not work as an external law, like gravity, or like causality, or something like that. It is empty. It is empty of existing the way we think it does, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist at all. Okay? It exists, it works, and all like that. So in this chapter, he's talking about the relationship between an actor and the action that the actor does. Karma, and the word is karma. Action, you know, karma means action. Karma can be translated as action. Okay? What is the relationship? Is there an independently existing agent or actor who then takes action? Right? Takes action. Is there an action that exists waiting for an actor to take it? Okay? I'll use the surfing example again. Is there a surfer who then goes surfing? And is there surfing waiting for a surfer to surf it? Neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. It is empty. The actor is empty, the agent is empty, and the action is empty, which means that they cannot exist independently. They can only exist dependently on each other, mutually dependent, which is another way of talking about independent, right? Mutually dependent. So it's interesting that he starts this whole question of who am I, you know, the emptiness of self, with agent and actor. Because we do identify with our actions. We do identify as an agent of action, don't we? When we think about ourselves. And so, one of the things I forgot to mention yesterday is that at the end of each one of these classes, there's an exercise. I don't know if you noticed that in your reading. That's like homework. And so the exercise for this class is to think about all the kinds of roles that we identify with. And to think about, like, whether it's possible to be one or another of those roles, an actor, independent of the action that the actor is acting. So if I say, for example, I am a teacher, which is one of the things I am, I guess. I'm a teacher. But, you know, listen to the language. The language always betrays us. I am a teacher. So what does that mean? That means that's who I am, essentially a teacher. Essentially, see? The language already misleads us into thinking that things have self-existence. I am a teacher. But how could I be a teacher unless I had students to teach? How could I be a teacher without teaching? See, the action is the cause of me being a teacher. Right? Just as I am the cause of being the teaching as a teacher. Right? A teacher is the cause of teaching. You can't have a teaching just free floating there without a teacher. Right? Have to have a teacher to have a teaching. And you have to have a teaching to have a teacher. And you also, in this case, have to have students who are students for you to be a teacher. You can't be a teacher teaching all to yourself. I'm a teacher of teaching. Who are you teaching? Nobody. Just me teaching. Things exist interdependently and not dependently. You can't be a student without a teacher teaching you. I'm a student. What are you doing? Oh, nothing. I'm, student. Well, are you learning anything? No, I'm a student. I don't need to learn anything. I'm a student all by myself, you see. Right? No, that's an independently existing student. Just like an independently existing teacher wouldn't need to teach students to be a teacher. Right? If they existed independently. Independently means not dependent on something else to be who they are. Okay? And we all, have a strong sense that we are independent. We have an independent nature somehow in here. Independent self. So it's another way, this whole kind of analysis of actor and action is another way to deconstruct our grasping to self. are grasping to the idea that we are who we think we are. So, you know, you could start, you know, start doing the homework now during class. How many, if I ask you, who are you? You know, sometimes at parties, you know, who are you? The other way of asking that is, what do you do? You know, what do you do? Well, I'm a professor, or I'm a, you know, plumber, or I'm a investment banker, or I am these things, right? And so then we identify with it. We identify with the agent self. And we think that that's who we are, and then we make the mistake of assuming that we are that independent, that we are that essentially. I mean, one of the, you know, when it comes to this kind of thing, one of the ways that you can, like, immediately start loosening the grip on error is to think, well, you know, are you only your job? See, are you only your profession? Well, no, I'm also a, you know, a father and a mother and a friend and a shopper and a, you know, a moviegoer and, you know, so who the hell are you? Nagarjuna will say at the end of this chapter, you know, we'll start it and then we'll end it. But I'll get to the end first, okay? We are what we do. And what we do, our actions, depends on who we are. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. We are what we do, and what we do depends on who we are. Okay? And there's no independent agent that does something, and there's no independent activity that the agent then does. See? So now he's getting at this, you know, now he's, never mind about causality and sprouts and all, okay? Nothing much at stake when it comes to seeds and sprouts, but what about me? Now he's attacking me. And I found in many, many years, and you know, in my own experience also, but in teaching this, that Nagarjuna is hard for people because there's so much resistance to what he's saying. Especially when it comes to the emptiness of self. Because the imaginary self that we think is in there puts up a big fight. And here's how it usually goes, okay, by the way. It usually goes, don't listen to him. You know. Space out. Think about what you're going to do after class. Hope that he'll tell a joke soon, but don't listen to the Nagarjunist, you know. It doesn't make any sense. And I could probably figure this out later. Later I'll figure out the problem, you know. Right now, I, you know. Right? Is the self the agent? Is the self the action of the, you know? Is the self one? Is the self many? You know, I don't know. Who cares? You know, the mind resists it. The mind, the self resists its own destruction, and that's why we stay in suffering. Actually, that's why we remain suffering, because there's so much resistance to the truth. To the truth, the truth shall set us free. Not illusion. We are attached to illusion, very strongly attached to illusion. So you ready? You ready for the attack on the self?
Yes.
Alright, let's start. Chapter 8. The analysis of actor and action. A truly existing actor. And here he says it quite like explicitly. Sadbhuta. Sadbhuta. Karaka. Sad means truly. Bhuta means existing. Say, a truly existing actor. So what does a truly existing actor mean? Okay, as opposed to an interdependently existing actor, what does a truly existing actor mean? An actor who exists independently. See, that's the only thing he means by truly existing. See, a truly existing, essentially existing actor would exist independently of the action that the actor takes. Okay? So here he's saying, a truly existing actor does not perform a truly existing act, activity, action. Nor does an actor who does not truly exist perform an action that does not truly exist. So what does it mean to say a truly existing actor does not perform a truly existing action? And again, I'll just kind of like summarize the commentary, and then, you know, if you think it's important, you might want to study it. A truly existing actor would mean an actor that exists independently of the action that the actor takes. Okay? So a truly existing actor wouldn't need to do action to be an actor. Wouldn't depend on action, right? Because they are exist independently as an actor. Okay? I haven't used the in the commentary here yet, but you know, the example we'll use in the next couple of verses is surfer. A truly existing surfer. And you can just plug in anything, okay? You know, mechanic or Dharma student or yoga student or, you know, whatever. A truly existing surfer wouldn't need to surf to be a surfer. Why? Already a surfer. What do I have to go surfing for? In Southern California, there's quite a few of those, actually. They got all the gear and, you know, spend hundreds of dollars on the clothes and stuff. And, you know, I'm a surfer. You ever surf? No. A truly existing actor does not perform a truly existing action. If they truly existed as a surfer, you wouldn't need to surf. It would be redundant. Right? I'm already a surfer. What do I have to go surfing? Nor does an actor who does not truly exist perform an action that does not truly exist. So what is an actor, a truly existing non-actor? Let's say that. Okay, say it like that. That means I'm a non-surfer. Okay, I am a non-surfer. I am a non-surfer. But a truly existing non-surfer would exist independently as a non-surfer. So here he's saying a non-surfer, a truly existing non-surfer, wouldn't have to not surf to be a non-surfer. Get it? Just like a truly existing surfer wouldn't need to surf to be a surfer, a truly existing non-surfer wouldn't need to not surf. So, you know, again, this is kind of a... This first verse is kind of a version of the conclusion that he's going to come to in that chapter. He often does this in the text. He introduces with the first verse his conclusion. So here's his conclusion, okay? There's no actor that exists independently of the action. There's no actor without an action. Doesn't mean anything to say that, right? To say I'm an actor but I don't act. There's no actor that exists independently from the action. Nor is there an action that exists independently from the actor. There's no surfing until and unless there's a surfer surfing. Right? There's no like sort of theoretical thing called surfing until and unless a surfer is surfing. Right? The actor makes the activity possible. But the activity makes the actor possible too. Neither one can exist without the other. And what's the other one? Neither can come first. So that's the key. That's the key one. Neither can come first. That's the one that will start blowing up your noodle. Baking your noodle, you know the expression? Bake your brain. So here's another version of that, okay? You know, this is one that I talked about yesterday, because sometimes you hear it, you know? This is another kind of an actor. I am a projector of my reality. Okay? Projector is an actor, right? It's an agent of some sort. I'm a projector of my reality. Could a projector exist independently of the reality that the projector is projecting? So Nagarjuna would say, that's just ridiculous. You are a projector. You become a projector when you project a projection. And you're not a projector until you project a projection. Any more than you're a surfer until and unless you surf. Right? The activity causes the actor, as well as the actor causing the activity. There's no projector without a projection, and there's no projection without a projector. And neither one can exist without the other, and... Yeah. So when we say, if you say, I am projecting my reality, you got to also say, and my reality is projecting me. Okay? And that kind of like, to say I project my reality without saying the other part, without saying, and my reality is projecting me, it enhances the idea of a separate self. It concretizes and strengthens the illusion of an independent self. I am a projector, and then pretty soon I'll project something. Yeah. So the interdependence, the second clause, and the projection is projecting the projector. The projector is projecting the projection, and the projection is necessary for the projector to be a projector. This helps us to loosen our grip on the ego, on the idea of an independent self. The idea, the phraseology, the concept of I am a projector strengthens that grip. Strengthens the grip on the self. Alright, next person. Someone who truly exists does no activity. For there would then be action without an actor. I looked this over this morning and, I don't think it should be for. It should be and, because it's cha there. Someone who truly exists does no activity, and there would then be action without an actor. Someone who truly exists does no activity, and there would then be an actor without an action. So again, here, you can read the commentary. What he's really saying here, I'll try and summarize it. Someone who truly exists, okay? Again, what does that mean? Truly exists. Independently, with some kind of self-nature. Does no activity. Because they already exist, essentially. They don't depend on the activity to be who they are. Someone who truly exists as a surfer, for example, does no activity. Doesn't need to surf. Why? Already a surfer. What do I need to surf for? Right? They're already who, essentially, who it is that, they are as an agent. Surfer, a banker. There's an expression also, writers write. Ever heard about that? Writers write. There's a lot of writers who don't write anything. Professional writers, what are you doing? Well, I'm working on something. Well, how's it going? Well, I'm kind of blocked. I'm a writer, but I haven't really written anything. You're not a writer until and unless you write, right? The writing makes you a writer. And you're, right? So there's no surf. So he's saying somebody who was really a writer, okay, really, independently, on their own, self-existently, wouldn't need to write. They're already a writer. What do I need to write for? It would be, like I said before, redundant. I'm a writer already. Why do I need to write some more? I'm a writer. I'm a surfer. I don't need to surf. And there would then be action without an actor, which means that if there was a self-existing writer who doesn't need to write to be a writer, there could be writing that doesn't need a writer to write it. You see? If these things existed independently, self-existently, they could exist without each other. Impossibly, right? What would it mean to say there's a writing that nobody's writing? That there's no writer writing? What would it mean to say there's surfing without a surfer surfing? What would it mean to say there's a surfer without the surfer surfing? See, the actor and the action exist interdependently, not independently. That's what he's saying, right? Someone who truly exists does no activity. He just repeats it again. And there would be then an actor without an action. There would be a surfer without surfing. There would be a writer without writing. Okay? So again, you can look at it. The surfer is a surfer dependent on surfing, right? A surfer is a surfer dependent on the activity of surfing, right? And surfing is an activity that's dependent on a surfer doing it. Right? No surfing without a surfer, no surfer without surfing. Neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Interdependence. You're starting to get what Nagarjuna is saying here, you know? So if you, you know, pay attention, he's just saying the same thing over and over again. You know, no, I mean, at first it's shocking and he's going, I don't get it and like that, but you know, once you get like, you know, the key, he's just saying the same thing over and over again. And then it's a matter of actually like believing it. You know, getting it intellectually, I don't think is that difficult. But deep down, understanding, you know, I'll just tell you from my own personal experience, Cindy will attest to this. You know, I sit for hours and hours, you know, translating the Sanskrit, looking at the commentaries, trying to figure out what the hell he's saying, trying, you know, writing these commentaries, you know, kind of like thinking I'm getting it now. And then I get up from my desk as if nothing happened. No, it's just like immediately. The ignorant way of thinking about things returns. That's how habituated we are to our own illusions. So, you know, you if you want to penetrate the illusion to get to the truth, it's, you know, it takes time and effort. You know, meditation especially. That's kind of what, you know, the meditational tool is really all about, ultimately, is to, you know, be able to concentrate your mind enough so that, you know, it gets burned in deep enough so that it makes a difference. You know, not just superficial intellectual understanding. All right, next verse, 8:4. And if a cause does not exist, so, you know, like, sorry, I skipped one, didn't I? 8:3. If an actor who did not truly exist, performed an action that did not truly exist, then there would be action without a cause and a causeless actor. So you can skip down to the second paragraph here. Nagarjuna writes in this verse, it is equally impossible to have a surfer if there was ever a time when they were not a surfer and not engaged in surfing. That's what he means in that phrase, an actor who did not truly exist. Or you could put it like this, a person who was essentially a non-surfer. Essentially a non-surfer. Just like there's essentially a surfer, he's doing the opposite. If there was somebody, an actor who did not truly exist, a truly existing non-surfer, how's that? Yeah. It is equally impossible to have a surfer if there was ever a time when they were not surfer. So if there was a time when they were truly existing as a non-surfer, how could they ever become a surfer? They're truly existing means essentially. Essentially a surfer. A truly existing, essentially existing non-surfer could never become a surfer by surfing. Right? That's kind of what he said. It is equally impossible to have a surfer if there ever was a time when they were not a surfer and not engaged in surfing, an actor who did not truly exist, performing an action that did not truly exist, non-surfing. A non-surfer who was performing non-surfing could never become anything other than that. And if they were not already essentially a surfer, how could they ever become one? So there would be no cause for them to be a surfer. A surfer essentially existing, either essentially existing surfer or an essentially existing non-surfer, would exist without cause. Because they essentially exist that way. Okay? They weren't caused to be a surfer. So, you know, of course they are caused to be a surfer. Right? Surfers become surfers because they surf. Right? The surfing causes them to be surfers. And the surfer becomes a surfer by surfing, caused by the surfing to be a surfer. But if they existed independently, they wouldn't be caused. Okay? Independent things are not caused, because they already exist that way, essentially. Okay? The surfer is the cause of surfing, and surfing is the cause of a surfer. Right? The surfer is the cause of surfing. There's no surfing without a surfer surfing. So surfer is the cause of the activity surfing. Yes? Writer is the cause of the activity writing. But surfing is also the cause of the surfer. Right? Writing, there's no writer without writing. Writing causes the writer. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can exist before the other. And if a cause does not exist, so now he turns to causality, right? So if they have these essentially existing surfers or non-surfers, that means they're causeless. And if a cause does not exist, neither an effect nor a sufficient condition can be observed. And when these are not observed, there is no action, no actor, and no doing of the activity. So here he introduces, another term. Cause and effect, we talked about yesterday, right? If a cause doesn't exist, you can't have an effect, right? No sense in saying that there's an effect until and unless there's a cause. An effect is an effect because it's caused, right? So without a cause, you can't have an effect. And then he uses this other term, a sufficient condition, karana, which means the conditions that make it possible for the cause to bring about its effect. So if you look at the second paragraph, return to the example of surfing. If, for example, there is no surfing, which is the cause of a surfer, right? If there's no cause, if there's no surfing, then there are no surfers, because they're the results of the cause, right? If there's no cause, there can't be an effect. Yes? And then there's no sufficient condition, which, you know, is in this instance, in this example, going surfing. Going surfing. Which means that, you know, you get a surfboard, and, you know, you put it in a car, and you find a surf spot, and, you know, you go paddle out, and, you start surfing. You go surfing, right? So without a surfer, there can't be surfing. Without surfing, there can't be a surfer. And without going surfing, the surfer can't surf. Okay? Yeah. Neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Okay? Can't be a surfer unless you go surfing, and you can't go surfing unless you actually surf. You're not going surfing unless you surf. I guess a lot of people do that too. They go surfing and they never end up surfing. But then you really haven't gone surfing. I used to do that a lot, actually. One of the great joys of surfing is that you get to waste a lot of time. And we would get up early in the morning and we would, what we call, take a reading. This was before the days of cams. You know, then they put the cams up on the beaches and you didn't have to go anywhere. You could just watch on the computer to see if there's any surf at the beaches. So you just drive around from one beach to another and say, you know, take a reading. Surf worth going out for, you know. That would take hours sometimes. And sometimes you'd never end up surfing because there was just no surf anywhere. So then you couldn't really say that you were going surfing. You were just kind of driving around. So you'd have to surf, you know, the going surfing requires the surfing that you've gone for. Right? So you can't be a surfer without going surfing. There can't be going surfing without the actual surfing. No one can exist without the other, and none can come first. Things exist interdependently, not independently. Yeah. When action and the rest are not ascertained, so action and the rest means the cause, the result, and the sufficient condition, then there is no ascertaining of what's right and what's wrong. Now here he starts to take the gloves off a little bit. If you believe that things exist independently, then morality starts to crumble. When action and the rest are not ascertained, then there is no ascertaining of what's right and wrong. Dharma or adharma. That's the words he used. Right and wrong. I translate it here. And when right and wrong don't exist, then no consequences can be ascertained that follow from either one. So now he introduces, you know, karma full on. And again, I'm going through this kind of quickly. Please, take the time to read the commentary if you'd like. I'll summarize, I think, what he's saying here. There's no good or bad actions apart from good. There's no good or bad actors apart from good or bad actions. Okay? a good or bad actor depends on the good or bad actions that they do to be a good or bad actor. Okay? And the other way around. There's no good or bad actions apart from a good or bad actor. Neither can exist without the other, neither can exist before the other. Okay? So what makes an actor good or bad, and what makes actions good or bad? And we'll come back to this in the 17th chapter, because he says, you know, quite clearly then. So I'll just give you a little preview. What makes you a good or bad actor is your intention. Is your intention. Is your intention harmful, or is your intention beneficent? Is it good or bad? And that's what makes the action good or bad, is the intention, not the action. A good or bad action that existed as a good or bad action apart from the good or bad actor would be an independently existing good or bad action. So, you know, you might say something like, you know, harming others is a bad action, right? That has to be qualified. It's not, if it's a bad action on its own, it means an independently bad action. Okay? So is there a time when harming others isn't a bad action? See, it depends. It depends on the motivation. It depends on the intention. If you went to the hospital with cancer, do you think that someone would harm you trying to help you? Surgery, also known as surgery. What, do you know what they do in surgery? They take a knife and they cut you open. Right? Is that harming? You know, in a way you could say, yes, of course it's harming. Yeah, the body is cut open. Blood comes out. If you didn't have anesthesia, you would hurt. Right? The same action, the same very, very same action, taking a knife and cutting open a body, can be a good action or a bad action depending on the motivation, on the intention of the actor. Right? Same action. So there are no independently good actions. And there are no independently good actors either. Right? The actor becomes good dependent on the intention. And the action becomes good or bad depending on the intention too. Hmm? Here's another way to look at it. So, you know, when it comes to karma, I know you guys came for karma, right? How does karma work and all of that? And, you know, it doesn't work the way we think it does, but it doesn't mean it doesn't work. So, since you are all so good, like, you know, plowing through emptiness here, I just, you know, give you a little sort of throwaway here. If karma is about intention, not about the action, you know, not about the independently good or bad action, and not about the independently good or bad actor either. Okay, there are no independently good or bad actors. An actor becomes good because of the action that the actor takes, and the action that the actor takes depends on the actor of who the actor is, right? And both of them depend on the intention. Both of them ultimately depend on the intention. So you can think about that in terms of karma, both in terms of cause and result. Both in terms of cause and result. The cause of an action is good or bad depending on the intention of the actor. Okay? Depending on the intention. Not depending on the action. This is very important, okay? You know, sometimes we get all like moralistic and clean to the idea that there are independently existing good actions and independently existing bad actions. That is not the karma. That's not how karma works. Okay. Karma works in the same way that everything else does. Interdependently, not independently. Okay, so on the basis of the intention. We'll see this like directly. You know, he talks about this, I'm giving you a preview. He talks about this directly in chapter 17. There's two kinds of karma. There's motivating karma and motivated karma. Motivating is intention. Motivated is what your intention has motivated, right? The action that your intention has motivated. And motivating karma is the most important. It is karma, the intention. So that's how it works in terms of cause. Is everyone clear on that? That's cool, right? That's easy. Isn't that easy? Depends on your intention. Is your intention kind or is your intention harmful? You could even say, we talked about this last night. I heard myself say that, physical harm to other people is really a bad thing in a relationship. But it depends on your intention, kind of. If a child has run into the street 47 times, small child running into the street over and over and over again, and for 46, 47 times you said, don't run in the street, don't run in the street, don't run in the street, and they keep running in the street, you might want to swat them upside the head. Right? I mean, you didn't hear it, apparently. So, how about that? Can you hear it then? And that's not really an act of violence, because the intention is love. The intention is wanting to protect. There's all kinds of examples of this. One of the examples that they sometimes use of how to deal with a violent person, is to think, this person is like my mother who has gone mad. I've gone home, I've come back to the house, and my mother has gone completely crazy. And she's running around with a butcher knife. Yeah? Trying to kill me and other people and stuff like that. So, does ahimsa mean, okay, mom, whatever. Okay. No. So that's not nonviolence. That's not real nonviolence. So it might mean that you try to wrestle the knife away from her, but maybe she gets out of the thing. It might mean you try and tackle her. And then if nothing else works, it might mean you knock her socks off, You punch her lights out. Right? To prevent her from hurting herself and others. Is that violence, you see? Physically, the action is the same as punching somebody else out of hatred or anger or something like that. But the intention is so different. See? Everything depends on intention. The intention is one of love, of, compassion, trying to help. See? Yeah. So that's intention in terms of its cause. How does intention work in terms of its effect? So, something to put in your pipe and smoke, okay? Karma has two aspects to it, cause and effect, right? Cause and fruit. How do you know that the fruit of karma is bad or good? See, how do you know that the event is a bad thing or a good thing? When it comes to other people especially, okay? So, somebody says something to you, okay? Somebody says something to you. How do you know that that's a good result, a karmic result, a good result that brought me, somebody saying this kind of thing to me, or a bad one? It depends on what you suppose their intention is, doesn't it? It depends on what you suppose their intention is. So they can even say something very, very harsh to you. But if you suppose that their intention is good, then you could regard that as good karma. Thank you. I got a very important lesson that was brought to me by somebody who really had my best intentions at heart. That was their intention. So they were trying to help me. Or you could say, their intention was to hurt me. But those very same words, exact same words, right? Their intention was to hurt me. And then the karmic result would be negative. Right? You would understand the karmic result as negative. I must have committed some bad karma in the past to have to hear words like this because this person's trying to hurt me. Okay? The words are the same. What makes it good or bad karma is your supposition about what the intention was. Can you know what somebody else's intention is? Huh? Can you? No. Can't know. Right? Can't know. Unless you can read minds. If you can read minds, well, maybe you can know their intention. But otherwise, you can't know whether... So, here's how you can change... Here, instant karma, okay? Change your karma in the moment. They always tell you you can't do that. But I'm telling you can, okay? Change your assumption about their intention. You can't know one way or the other. Somebody says, you're ugly. Oh, that's such bad karma. I must have called somebody ugly in the past. Blah, blah, blah. see, that's kind of like an independently existing mechanism of karma, to think that way. I said somebody was ugly in the past, now somebody's saying I'm ugly. See, what was the intention? Saying somebody is ugly is not necessarily a negative thing, you know? You can say that out of with funny or, you know, laughter or, you know, with love and whatever. Is it possible to say that? Cindy wouldn't believe that, I guess. Your beard's too long. Oh, I must have said something in the past that, you know, insulted somebody with their beard. And now they're saying something. But, you know, maybe they just don't want it getting caught in, like, machinery or, you know, something. You see, you get the point, right? You can change the karmic result in the moment by changing your assumption about what the intention was behind the action or the words. In the moment, karma is empty. That's one of the implications of karma, saying karma is empty. Yeah. All right, next verse. If there were no consequences, there would be no path. So now he's back to, like, you know, this whole thing. If, you know, if you don't say that there's causality when it comes to karma, well, then there's no path. There was no path that would lead to freedom in heaven. Heaven here probably means higher births, by the way. And there would be no purpose in any activity if there weren't a necessary relationship between cause and effect. But it's not the relationship that we think. Okay? Again, what's the relationship that we think between? Now we can talk about karmic cause and karmic effect, you know, between the actor and the action that the actor takes and the consequences of that action. So what's what we usually think? We think, well, there's an actor who then does an action, and then there are consequences of that action. Right? Sequential. All unfolding sequentially. Is that how it works? You've all, you know, spent class and a half listening to Nagarjuna and say that is impossible. Right? There's no cause without an effect. There's no effect without a cause. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Yeah. So, you know, what he's doing here, you know, in this verse, he's hinting at it. He does this regularly. He says, if things weren't empty, how could karma work? See? If things weren't empty, how could causation work? Things work the way they do because they are empty. So it's very interesting for those of you, you know, who like Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is affirming common sense. He's affirming common sense. You know, things do work the way they seem to, in a way, right? They can only work the way they seem to. They can only work the way they seem to because they are empty. If they weren't empty, how could they possibly work the way they seem? How could cause and effect possibly work? An actor who both exists and does not exist does not do that which both exists or does not exist. Okay, we're back to headache Nagarjuna. How could what exists and does not exist occur simultaneously when they are mutually exclusive? All right, so now we'll go through the commentary a little bit. First, so he says, an actor who both exists and does not do that which both exists or does not exist. A truly existing actor could not bring about a truly existing action. We've already covered that, right? Why? Because they already exist. The actor already exists. The surfer already exists. We wouldn't bring about a surfing because the surfer is already surfer. And the surfing, if it truly existed, wouldn't need a surfer to surf. It would be surfing all by itself, right? One truly existing thing cannot bring about or depend on another because they both would already truly exist. So it's not possible for a truly existing actor to, or a surfer who doesn't need to surf to be a surfer. That's a truly existing surfer. A surfer who doesn't need to surf to be a surfer is a truly existing surfer. Truly existing actor. To do a truly existing action. Surfing, right? Which is, if it were truly existing, wouldn't need a surfer to surf, to be surfing, right? Truly existing means independent. Independent, doesn't depend on something else. But neither is it possible for a non-existing actor, a non-surfer, to do a non-existing action, like non-surfing. For again, being a truly non-existing actor, a non-existing surfer, and a truly non-existing action would be independent of each other. So you wouldn't, a non-surfer wouldn't depend on non-surfing to be a non-surfer. Okay? Everyone alright with this? Keep nodding or I'll just repeat it over and over again. Then Nagarjuna has noted that it would make no sense to say that actors and actions exist outside of causality either. Surfers are caused by surfing. And surfing is caused by surfers surfing. Right? And it wouldn't make any sense to say that they existed outside of causality either. In this verse, he rejects another possibility. Someone can't be both an actor and a non-actor. If they existed essentially as a surfer, you couldn't be a non-surfer as well. Okay? One or the other. Mutual exclusivity. Have to be one or the other. The law of non-contradiction, as it says in the last thing. If things and beings truly existed, they would have to be one thing or the other. If there were truly existing surfers or writers or teachers or something like that, they could never be anything other than that. They couldn't be a teacher and then sometimes be not a teacher. Couldn't be a surfer and then sometimes be not a surfer. Why? Because they are a surfer. Okay? Yeah. Something that does not exist is not produced by an actor who does not exist. And something that does exist is not produced by an actor who does not truly exist. All the same errors would follow from that. So if you skip down to the second paragraph, a truly existing actor could not produce a truly non-existent action. The essentially existing surfer could not not surf. Okay, now he's like kind of turning it inside out. We said earlier that if you were fundamentally, essentially, truly, independently on your own, a surfer, you wouldn't need to surf, because you're a surfer. Now he's saying, something that does not exist is not produced by an actor who does not exist. So if you were a truly existing surfer, you could never be a truly existing non-surfer, not surfing. In other words, you would always be surfing. You'd never take a break. You'd never, you know, go for lunch. You'd never go take a shower. Just always have to go. Why? Because I'm a surfer. I can't do anything else. I'm a surfer. So you can either say, if you're an essentially existing surfer, you could either say that a consequence of that is that you would either never have to do the activity because you're already it. You never have to surf because you're already a surfer. Or that you would always have to do the activity. Because you're a surfer. What else can I do? I'm a surfer. You see what I mean? Impossible. You know, he's just kind of playing with it. It's like a cat plays with a mouse. He's just playing. Well, how do you think things out? How do you think somebody could be a surfer? You know? How do you think that you could be any of the roles that you play? Really? See? How could you be a businessman or a businesswoman? How could you be a teacher or a plumber? How could you be a roller skater? What does it mean to say these things? Things can't exist the way that we oftentimes think they do. They do exist, but they exist interdependently. The actor exists dependently on the action that the actor does. The action exists dependently on an actor who's acting it. Neither can exist without the other. Neither can. All right, we'll finish up with that. An actor who truly exists does not produce an action that does not truly exist. So an actor, a truly existing actor, does not do something that is not an actor, an action. So a truly existing surfer does not also not surf. Doesn't produce a non-existent, does not produce an action that does not truly exist. Or an action that both truly exists and doesn't truly exist because of mutual, what do you call it, exclusivity. Can't be one. If it can't be one thing, it can't. If it can't be one thing, it can't be that thing and something else at the same time. Also, an actor who does not truly exist does not produce an action which truly exists, or an action which both truly exists and truly does not exist. The reasons for this have been summarized previously, so you can read the commentary. He's just like mopping up now. The mopping up offer. It should be known also, for reasons that have been mentioned previously, that an actor who both truly exists and does not truly exist cannot perform an action that both truly exists and does not truly exist. Non-contradiction. Can't, a law of non-contradiction just applied again. An actor, here's the cachet, okay? 8:12. It's the main verse. An actor occurs in dependence on the action. Okay? An actor is an actor when the actor does something. An action. Right? The actor depends on the action. And the action also occurs in dependence on the actor. And then he says, can't see any other way to define it. You know, how else are you going to like understand it except for interdependent? Impossible, right? These terms don't mean anything without the other term, right? An actor doesn't mean anything until and unless an actor is does some action. And there's no action that can exist independently of an actor who's doing the action. It's the only way that they can exist. The only way that they can exist is interdependently. Impossible for them to exist independently. Right? So he's using logic to show that our ordinary way of thinking about things is impossible. Ordinary way of grasping to some independently existing, you know, actor or role, I am a teacher, is impossible. You can only be a teacher if you are teaching, right? And you can only teach if there are students who are being taught. One can't exist without the other. No one of them can exist without the other, and no one can come first. Yeah. That's the important thing to put in the pipe and smoke, okay? No one of these, you know, actors or actions or the recipient of the action can exist without the other two, and no one can come first. Last verse. And so from this refutation of action and actor, so you know, he's doing his kind of Muhammad Ali thing here. Okay, so I like blew that out of the water. This refutation of action and actor. Grasping also should be understood. So now he brings in grasping. Upadana. In the commentary, you'll see like how important this concept is in Buddhist understanding of why we are suffering. We are suffering because we grasp, fundamentally. Okay, we grasp because we crave. We desire, we crave. And then we grasp to the things that we like, and we grasp in the sense of pushing away the things that we don't like. And he's saying, it's just like this refutation, this whole chapter can be applied to grasping. So what does he mean by that? There is no grasper until and unless the grasper grasps. And there's no grasping unless there's a grasper who grasps to a grasped up. To something grasped. Okay? There's no grasper without the action of grasping. And there's no grasper or grasping unless there's something that is grasped. Okay? So how does it go with Nagarjuna? Run the formula. And no one can exist without the other two, and none can come first. Okay. So how do we break out of samsara? Well, you stop grasping, right? Well, how do you stop grasping? And really the answer to that question is that, you know, you understand deeply what the hell he's talking about in these verses. You get some wisdom about how things exist. They, you know, the problem with grasping is that we think that there is an independent grasper who wants to grasp onto something out there that exists independently, and then there is the action that brings that about, right? And that's just not the way grasping works, actually. Grasping can't work that way. There can't be a grasper without something grasped. There can't be something grasped without a grasp for grasping, without a grasper. And there can't be either the grasped or the grasper without what? The grasping. No one can exist without the other two, and none of them can come first. So things do work. Things do exist, but not the way that we think. Okay? They do not exist sequentially. They cannot exist sequentially. There can't be an actor until and unless there's an action that the actor does, right? And there can't be an action until and unless there's an actor who does that action. So there can't be an actor who then does an action. Okay? They're not an actor until they do the action. And the action isn't there to do until the actor is doing it. Okay? And everything exists that way. And nothing exists in any other way than that. So, again, back to interdependence. You know, think about interdependence. How do things really work? How does causality work? How does karma work? How does action work? Like in a dream. Like in a dream. Okay? Yeah. And not really. Because, you know, if it really worked, the way, you know, really is another way for independently, self, with some kind of self-nature, really. If it really were that way, it would be impossible. Okay? The way we ordinarily think about reality is absolutely impossible. No actor without an action. No action without an actor. None can exist without the other. No one can come first. So, if it's everything exists only like a dream, does that mean it doesn't have any kind of reality? Do dreams have a reality? When you're dreaming, they have a reality, don't they? Yeah, when you're in a dream, it seems very, very real, right? When you're in this dream, it seems very, very real. We are in an illusion. You know, we have to be. That's the problem. The problem is that we are in Maya. We are living in an illusion. We are living in, you know, in a dreamlike state. And that's why they call the goal Bodhi. Bodhi. Buddha is a Bodhi. It was somebody who has bodhied. What does Bodhi mean? Awakened. Awakened from the dream. A Buddha is a... Somebody, in the Buddhist text, there's a story. Somebody comes to the Buddha after, you know, the Buddha's awakening, enlightenment. And he says, Are you a man or are you a god? And the Buddha says, I am awake. I am awake. Yeah. So the goal is to awaken from the dream. But we have to recognize it as a dream before we can awaken from it, right? Yeah. So another way of thinking about these, you know, this hard work that we do on Sunday afternoons here at Oasis is to begin to awaken. Begin to awaken from our certainty that it is not a dream. That is, it's got this reality that is impossible for it to happen. It's like, you know, our ideas about things are not the way they are. That's another kind of way that you can talk about emptiness. Because now in this lesson, things are empty of existing self-existently, which means that they do exist interdependently. Things are also empty, you could say, of existing the way we think that they exist. Existing in the way that our concepts and our theories and our ideas about how things exist, you know, claim that they exist. Things are empty of that, which means that they do exist, but not the way we think that they do. And as I was saying yesterday, you know, like, a lot of people wonder, well, what the hell did I do for 2 hours here? You know, what's the point? Right? And, you know, after many years of studying, you know, Nagarjuna, here's what I think the point is. The point is to relax. He ends the chapter with grasping. There, you know, I was thinking about this earlier today. One of the strongest things, we grasp to the self. That's a very strong thing that we grasp to. But another thing that we strongly grasp to is being right. We grasp strongly to the idea, I will be right, or I can be right, or I am right. Which always involves also somebody else being wrong, by the way. Yeah. And one of the things I think that a study of texts like this helps us to attain is a little more humility. None of us are right. None of us are right. All intellectual theories, all concepts, all ideas, all doctrines, all dogmas are not right. They are all by necessity, because they involve words and language and concepts, distortions. They're all distortions. And so that really bothers people. No, wait, I want the right answer, you know. I spent 2 hours here studying Nagarjuna. What's the right answer? How, you know? And that's kind of his point. His point is to say, stop grasping to right answers. Stop grasping to the idea that you can nail it, that you can somehow pin this butterfly of reality down with your intellect, and relax already. So it's hard. It's hard for people like us, you know, to let go and to say, I don't know. That's the mantra, okay? So you can chant that mantra between now and tomorrow night. And relax. Things do work. Karma does work. Causality does work. But in ways that are unknowable to us. Okay? The Tao that can be named is not the true Tao. The reality that can be put into language and concepts and doctrines and so forth is not really the real reality. I bow down to the Buddha, Nagarjuna says. I bow down to the Buddha that taught, get rid of all concepts. Get rid of all conceptual thinking. Get rid of drishtis. Get rid of views, worldviews, doctrines, dogmas, and isms and ologies. Let it go. They're all just fingers. All just fingers pointing to the moon that cannot be described. And so then, people forget that, and they get attached to their fingers. Get attached to, I'm a Buddhist, no, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Christian, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a secular humanist, I'm an atheist, I got the right idea. My finger is better than your finger. People for centuries, for millennia, have had big finger wars, about whose finger is better than somebody else's finger. They're all just fingers, they're not the moon. All just fingers pointing to the same. So relax. Be happy. That's a phrase that's often found in texts like this. Suki Baba. Suki Baba. Just be happy already, Just relax. Stop stressing. Stop thinking that you can control the world with your mind. Just relax. No, isn't it true? Isn't it? When we are relaxed, we're not interested in control, right? When we're relaxed, we just enjoy. We just, we're in the moment, we just relax. We don't try to, push things around or change things or direct our will on things. So, nirvana, that's nirvana. Nirvana is the ultimate relaxation. So you can work towards nirvana by starting to relax more. And especially about really, especially about the intellect. The intellect has its purposes. But, there is a limit. There is a limit to the intellect. And the guardian is good at showing where that limit is. All right, thank you. Questions, really quickly? Yeah.
Thank you for the question. I understand a bit briefly about this reputation of the self-existence.
Reputation of?
Of things existing independently.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to be pointing to the fact that things does exist interdependently.
No, he does point to that.
So my question is, does things that exist interdependently and independent truth?
Is the truth of interdependence independently true?
Yes.
It depends. The truth. truth of interdependence is also empty. Another way of talking about that is, dependent origination or interdependence is itself empty of working on its own. Yeah, everything depends on everything, including interdependence, which depends on everything also. Or you can put it like this. Another way of getting at that is talking about what they call the emptiness of emptiness. So, emptiness means that things do not exist independently, but only interdependently. And that includes emptiness itself. Because emptiness depends on something that's empty. Okay? Form is emptiness and emptiness is form, as it says in the Part Sutra, right? You have to have a cup for there to be the emptiness of the cup. And there has to be emptiness of the cup for there to be a cup. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Because the cup is empty of having self-existence, it can be the cup that it is. Okay? It depends on its emptiness to be what it is. But the emptiness of the cup, the absence of self-existence to the cup, depends on a cup that it doesn't have self-existence. No, I mean, I was saying this yesterday. Sometimes, people get attached to emptiness. And they think, well, emptiness is some kind of deeper, ultimate reality. And we're sometimes misled because there's language like that in the text, actually. They talk about two realities, two suches, deceptive reality and ultimate reality. But there can only be one reality. I mean, this is not the Twilight Zone or something like that. There's just like alternate realities or something. There's only one reality. But that one reality has different faces, you could say. There's the emptiness face and there's the dependent origination face. There's the form face and the emptiness face, but they are the same thing, seen from different perspectives. Exactly the same. So Nagarjuna, at some point in his text, says there is no difference whatsoever between nirvana and samsara, for example. No difference whatsoever. They are the same thing. Two ways of looking at the same thing, he said. There's a nirvana way of looking at the thing, and there's a samsara way of looking at it. He also says, dependent origination is emptiness. Very clearly. But so, what do you mean dependent origination is emptiness? They're just two ways of talking about the same thing. Things exist interdependently, and they are empty of existing independently. It's the same proposition. It's the same thing. Same.
We are what we do what we are. That's the process of doing something else, becoming something more.
It works interdependently. You become something more by doing something more, but you do something more by being something more. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can go first. Yeah. Well, it's hard because, the idea of self-improvement, for example, the way we usually think of it, is that I'm a self and I will improve myself by doing an action. Right? And that's precisely what Nagarjuna has been undercutting from this whole chapter. That idea that's the way it's working. You'll improve yourself when you have a better self-conception, and you'll have a better self-conception when you improve yourself. And neither one can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. Tomorrow we'll talk a little bit. We'll talk directly about karma. I've thought a lot about karma, and partly in response to what I've been learning from Nagarjuna. And so, just to leave us with something. Tomorrow's class is about not so much agent and action, but what about the past, how does karma survive over time? You do a karmic act, and then time goes by, and you supposedly receive a karmic result, and how does that work? And again, you'll say, it can't work the way we think it does. But it does work. So how would it work? And don't know, just as a something to think about. We don't have karma. We are karma. Okay? It's not there's a self that has karma. So that would be an independently existing self and an independently existing karma that you have. They're two different things. We are karma. So what does that mean? It means just as we are what we do, we are our karma. And you can't separate them. There's no self without the karma, and there's no karma without the self. So we are our karma. So the question of where karma is stored is a kind of an age-old question of Buddhist philosophy. In some schools, they developed a whole part of the brain of the consciousness that just was like a storehouse that, you know, kept all those karmic seeds in there waiting to ripen and all like that. And Nagarjuna would certainly not believe that. That would be an unchanging thing, and, you know, all kinds of problems with that. So where is karma stored? And, you know, we'll hit it tomorrow night and Tuesday night. But you might think about it like this. Karma is stored in the simple sense of me. The simple sense of who I am. So that's why I say you don't have karma, you are karma. So all your karma is present at every moment. Every moment is the summation of all the karma that you have. So you are who you think you once were. There's another way of thinking about karma. We are who we think we once were. And when we're thinking about who we once were, when are we thinking about that? Where is memory? You know, memory is just a part of the present mind. Yeah. So, if we are, you know, another way of talking about this is we are our memories. Who would you be without memory? Say, quick. You say, who would you be at all? There's no possibility of personal identity without memory, right? So our sense of self is a function of our memory, right? And our memory is another way of talking about karma. What we think we said, did, or even thought in the past. So that's why we are our karma, because we are our memories. And every moment we create new memories for ourselves, don't we? For the future. So you are now who you think you once were, and you will be who you think you once were next week. And part of who you'll be next week is who you are now. Is your memories of what you did, said, or thought now. So what kind of a person do you want to think of yourself as? And that's why karma works, and that's why it's important to do good and not bad. Because of who you will be. You are your karma. Don't have karma. Is that okay? Get that? Yeah. It's a different way of thinking about karma, right? But it's one that kind of tends to avoid the problems that Nagarjuna is pointing out and will point out in chapter 17 on how karma is stored and how it, you know, continues and, you know, over time when everything's changing and all of that. It's a, you know, it's a huge problem. But if you think about karma as personal identity and, you know, memory and personal identity, some of those problems get avoided. Yeah, Mary Lynn?
How does the position work in greater world problems?
Yeah.
But these problems sort of amalgamate to a very big world problem.
Yeah.
So how do you use karma or positional to solve these bigger world problems?
Well, I mean, again, Nagarjuna is not saying that there isn't causation. He's just saying that causation is empty of existing on its own. So, you know, part of what that means is that there has to be agents for there to be causes and effects. Causation just can't happen on its own. So pollution doesn't just happen. Pollution is, you know, depends on polluters. And polluters and pollution depends on polluted. And none can exist without the other, and none can exist first. There's no polluter, and there's no pollution without a polluter. and there's no polluter without pollution, but that neither of them exists also without a sense of being polluted. Polluted. The polluted, the, you know, the recipient of pollution. Yeah. So they all come together. They exist interdependently. And as I said yesterday, I mean, you know, if you change one, you change them all. Because things exist interdependently, if you change one, you change them all. So that, you know, in the case that you're mentioning, you could, you know, you could change polluters, you could change the pollution, or you could change the sense of being polluted. And if you changed one, you would change them all. I'm not a futurist. I, you know, have no crystal ball or anything. But you know, I think on the basis even of recent history, you know, you could say that we are changing our sense of what counts as polluted. You know, people live in circumstances thinking that, you know, it's pretty good, that would have been abhorrent not so long ago. And that changes the whole dynamic. Right? Yeah. Which is not to say that, you know, maybe you shouldn't try to change the polluters and the pollution also. But I'm just pointing out that if you change one, you change all three. Enough, guys. Oh, all right.
How does meditation help your intention?
A very good question. You can firm up your intention. You can strengthen your intention through meditation. Meditation is really concentration and focus. And so you focus on good intentions in a meditation practice, and you'll be much more likely to have those good intentions when you're not meditating later. Yeah. Don't meditate on bad intentions. Yeah, Rob.
Yeah, I think it's sort of key takeaway for me from looking back to the text is the key focus is really on the now horizon, in the sense that there's only one time horizon that will be in relation to tomorrow, which is right now.
Yeah, that's right.
And the right now is something that
That's right. And that's part of the relaxation thing that I keep mentioning, you know? If we lived in the present, we'd be a whole lot more relaxed than we are. Right? No, I mean, I was talking to the kids at school the other day, in Ethan's class, about stress. You know, stress comes from, like, imagining what's going to happen in the future all the time, doesn't it? Imagining all the things that can go wrong in a time that does not exist. And so, you know, just concentrating on the present, you know, immediately the stress will alleviate, immediately. Nagarjuna has a whole chapter on this, that of course there is no present. The way we think that there is. That time exists in exactly the same way that everything else does, which is how? Interdependently and not independently. So there is no present without a past and a future. And there's no past without a present and a future. And there's no future without a past and a present. You see, there's no sense in which, you know, there is a present, unless it's in relationship to past and future. And then you can do that formula too, which is kind of, you know, funky. No one can exist without the other, and no one can come first. And no, he does that. It's impossible for there to be a past before there is a present and a future. I mean, what? No, for the same reason. Like, if there was a past that didn't depend on a present and a future, that would be an independently existing past. So the past depends on a present and a future to be a past. And the present depends on a past and a future to be the present. And the future depends on a present and a past to be the future. And no one can exist without the other, and...